Where warp meets weft.
Where warp meets weft.
This is Weavecast with Sine Mitchell.
Welcome to Weavecast. This is episode 48, Roderick Owen. Okay, one, two, three.
Happy holidays!
That was my lovely husband, Eric, and my adorable son, Kai. That's our holiday shout out to you. I hope wherever you are, you're having a wonderful holiday season. This year, we just kind of stayed close to home and had a quiet Christmas. Sometimes small and quiet is exactly what you need. This episode, I have a real treat for you. We're going to talk with the very charming Roderick Owen about kumihimo and other types of braids. Now, if you're not familiar with kumihimo, it's a Japanese style of braiding that creates beautiful and very strong braids. In fact, climbing rope has a kumihimo structure to it. The most common form of kumihimo is braided on a piece of equipment called a marudai, which is essentially a small round table with a hole in it. Now, the braid forms in this hole and is tensioned with a counterweight that pulls it down as it's being woven. And the threads that are weaving this cord hang over the edge of the disc, and they are tensioned with weighted bobbins. The movements that are used to create kumihimo are as graceful as Tai Chi. It's just a really beautiful art form to watch. Roderick Owen is an expert in the art of kumihimo and other types of braiding, and he has written several books on the subject. He's recorded a DVD for Victorian Video and taught all over the world. In addition, he is just an utter delight to spend an afternoon with. Before we dive into the interview, a quick word from our sponsors. Over the last 9 years, Braider's Hand has established a reputation for building the finest kumihimo equipment money can buy. Their equipment is built using hard maple in their workshop in Washington State. They offer traditional silk and synthetic threads, books, kumihimo disc and plate kits, and books on other forms of braiding. Please visit their website for details, www.braidershand.com. As a side note, the interview you're going to hear with Roderick Owen was actually recorded in the Braider's Hand workshop. He was visiting the U.S., and had stopped by to go over some equipment that they were designing. So it was very interesting to get to see the workshop and get to see some of their new equipment in the design process. Our other sponsor this episode is Webs. Yarn.com is the online home of Webs, America's yarn store, where you'll find everything you need for weaving and more. Webs carries a variety of yarns, accessories, tools, and looms for weavers from beginner to advanced. Save up to 25% off your yarn and book order every day at yarn.com. I'm delighted to have Webs as a sponsor because I have so enjoyed their yarns. In fact, right now I believe they're having their blowout end of the year sale, which makes their website even more dangerous than usual.
My name is Roderick Owen.
I'm here on Whidbey Island, sitting in a wood shop where they make kumihimo equipment, which I guess is appropriate.
Appropriate, yes, very appropriate. I'm enjoying Whidbey Island. It's like I don't think anybody lives here, really. It's just houses. There's nobody around. There's no traffic on the road. And I think everybody has come out of their houses after 12 p.m. Right.
Do you ever write fantasy?
No, I've thought about it, but well, I never have done.
That's a very fantastical description.
Well, I sort of think about it now and again. But I'm so damn busy with braids, you know. It's sort of an obligation, which I'm wondering whether I want to... Like, I'm 78 now, for goodness sake. What am I going to do the rest of my life? I said to myself, well, okay, you've been doing a braids for so long, you really ought to get back to you. Root, and that's what started me thinking about Peruvian braids, but that's not where I started. It started way back in 1973 when I was helping at a summer school for children and adults. I was looking after the art room I used to paint. There was a book and there was some yarn, and I had 2 weeks before anybody turned up. I just started making a braid.
What was the book? Do you remember?
Yes, I do, very well. It was Alter Turner's Little Book of Indian Finger Weaving, at that time published by Little Oak Tree Press, but it's now been taken up and I think it's published by the Cherokee Reserve in America. That book started me off. It wasn't a big thing, but then people said, well, could you make me one? And I made one, and then people said, could you show me? That went on, so 73 through to, I guess, 78. I was living in France at the time. Then I came back to England and living in London, and I happened to stumble into the Craft Council building, saw a wonderful Peter Collingwood alphabet belt. I thought, oh, that looks good. And then right beside that was a little booklet about the London Guild of Weavers. So I went along there, and there I met Pat Maloney. And Pat Maloney said to me, you ought to come to college. She was the tutor in charge at London College of Furniture. So I went there for 2 years. From there, what happened is that I was doing braids all the time, not only that tablet weave, but anything to do with narrow fabrics. And I ended up teaching there 13 years.
What is it about narrow fabrics that kept your interest?
That you have your hands in the fibres. There's not something in the way. I don't know. You know, why do people knit? It's something that's inside you. It's something which you feel more than think about. It's not a head thing, it's a body thing. So it's very intuitive that I do that. When I was 17, I learned to embroider. So it's something that's not, it's been there, waiting to come out somehow.
Did you ever have any inkling like maybe I should do wider fabrics?
Well, I did, actually. I came out of college. You're given three subjects. You do knitting and you do weaving, and I did tapestry weaving. And I came out saying, well, I really want to be a tapestry weaver. So I did that, and I was offered a one-man exhibition very soon after coming out of college. And I'd done just two commissions on tapestry weaving. And then I thought, oh, maybe I can make these braids bigger. So I started doing large hangings, and that's what the first exhibition was about. When the exhibition finished, I thought, well, these are my tapestries. And I then adopted the title of braid maker. So braid maker is what I became. I didn't think of myself anything else other than, but that was a statement, that's what I do. But the braids I was interested in are oblique interlaced structures. And so I started teaching that in England to weavers' guilds and to conferences that I went to.
Can you define what oblique interlaced structure means?
Yeah. A structure that's not got vertical and horizontal structure. So it moves from the center to the edge, from the edge through the center to the other side. That's about the best explanation I give right now without wanting to draw a picture about it.
So you would see diagonals.
Thank you. Yes, that's exactly what you do see. It's diagonal. It forms basic structures, chevrons and diamonds. And things develop from there to the big structures. So you just extrapolate something that's very small and make it much, much larger by adding on elements. So each braid's comprised of three elements. Make six, you've got a new unit. Then you put 12 and 18, and suddenly the whole thing expands. Mm-hmm. I worked a couple of conferences when Peter Collingwood was there at the same time. And we used to have a lot of fun together, doing spoonerisms and all sorts of things, but also structure silly things. One day he said to me, well, what about Japanese braids? I said, what Japanese braids? Didn't you mean they make braids? I just didn't know that they did. Anyway, what happened, and this is the whole basis of how I came to Kumihima, is I found a book and I thought, okay, I see the equipment, I see what they're doing. It's the same as Peruvian sling braid. And I wrote to the author and I got back in a parcel a maradai with 16 bobbins and the weights as a gift. And I was the first English sympathiser. There I was with this stool wanting to make Peruvian braids on this, which is what I did, and making also from the book the Japanese equivalent. And that's how my first book came about. Because I started teaching both of those and the maradais, and I had maradais made. And you go through the whole process where you can't teach without a maradai, so you get somebody to make them for you. And slowly what happened, people say, well, you know, will you write a book? And I thought, well, heck, I hadn't thought about it. But one of the workshops I was on, one of the women's husband was the director of Cassell, the book publisher. So she arranged for me to have an interview with the editor. I did. They agreed to go ahead. So that's how the first book happened. You know, you just mind your own business and it happens for you.
You're a very persuasive guy. You write one letter and people send you Maradise. You go meet with an editor, they give you a book.
Yeah, well, I hadn't thought of quite about it quite like that. It's like doors opening. I think if your intention is right and you're trying to present things in a way that's going to be helpful for others, then doors do open. You're giving, not trying to take. The second book, that was, I suppose, my own initiative. I felt I wanted to do something so other people could understand it because it was so distant and not available for people in the Western Hemisphere. There was no books around at that time. That's how I came to write it.
When you finished the first book, had you felt like you'd said everything you'd wanted to say?
No, I hadn't, because there was parts of that I couldn't get into the first book. There just wasn't enough space. It was like the second book. They had to leave things out, just to not enough pages. You have to edit out. And what was edited out of the first book was all the Peruvian braids that carry cores, so carry additional threads through the centre of the braid, which you can bring out and make different beautiful patterns. Now, Adele Calanda wrote a book called Sling Braids of the Andes, which in fact shows you how to make these sling braids. And of course, they're all made in the traditional way the Peruvians would make them, in the hand, with no device at all. So the invention of the little square card that I originally devised for the first book can be used for those core braids. And that's what I'm working on now. Braider's hand to develop a piece of equipment so it can be done there. And I've got to write the instructions. And that will be some sort of publication, but I'm not sure exactly when that's going to happen.
I want to go back to the Peruvian braids. When you found Kumihimo, you were like, oh, this is the Peruvian braid technique. Are they exactly the same technique, but with different equipment? Or are there differences?
This is coming back to the sling braids, where all the Peruvian braids like this were made in the hand. There was no equipment. But the Japanese, because they had Maradise tools and, of course, other equipment that they use, it makes it more accessible for people to use a piece of equipment, because making braids in your hand is a very tedious and drawn out procedure, and you've really got to know structure. Well, a lot of people do not understand structure. What I try to do when I'm writing is to have some sort of verbal and graphic instruction so that it caters for lots of people's perception of how they learn. And it's the same with when you're learning without any publication. You've got something in your hand trying to work it. People either don't have the patience or they don't have the dexterity to do it like that. Therefore, the Maradai gives them that ability. It's more visual. It's a round stool, 10 inches in diameter. You have a set of threads which are weighted on the end of bobbins, and you can move those around in a sequence, which is more visible than holding threads in your hand. So that's the advantage.
Are the weave structures the same?
Are they the same? They're not, and yet they are. Peruvians work on a square of clockwise and counterclockwise move. The Japanese don't. They tend to work on a whole system of moving threads which have a sequence, a rhythm to them. They're not fixed by that squareness of clockwise, counterclockwise. So there's more freedom, if you like, with Japanese designs. You can create far more designs than you can Peruvian ones. Each culture has its differences, but the sameness.
When you're creating your braids, do you think of them as embellishments, or do you think of them as pieces of art in their own right?
Both. I make braids because I like making braids. When this first book was published, called Braids, 250 Patterns from Japan, Peru and Beyond, fortunately I lived in London, so I was in the office all the time. And I worked closely with them, and that was a heck of an advantage in producing this book. They said to me at the end, look, we need to put some finished things in here, things that people can make. I thought, oh. And I hadn't really considered it. So what happened is I thought, well, what the heck can I make? And I thought, oh, jewellery. That's when I started thinking about making things. Here again, I'm pushed into a corner. 3 weeks, produced 6 pieces to go in the book. And that was a challenge. And it was a challenge for 2 points, because London does not have a lot of bead shops. And they don't have a lot of beads. Well, they didn't at that time. It was a real creative journey and to produce some of these things. But I was really pleased at the end. One piece that I never really finished, which did get put in the book at the end, was a hairband I made for my daughter, Megan. It's an off-ray ribbon that's 5 millimeters in width. It's made round a stick. You make it round a dowel. And the important thing is to keep it hollow as you make it, like with weights on the Maradai, it just pulls the braid through and it all becomes a tight structure. So you have to introduce a former, which was a piece of dowel stick sharpened like a pencil, and I put it down the centre of the Maradai hole and made the braid around it. And you've got to be careful that the counterbalance weight hangs onto the stick and not onto the braid, so it retains its hollowness.
Oh, it's like a Chinese finger trap.
Yeah, it's exactly like that. And then you sort of carefully take it off, and then I inserted a hair, plastic hairband into it, and then tied off the ends and then embellished it afterwards. There's other things, a lot of people using braids for jewellery these days. Medley Freeman, she did some really nice embellishment on the jacket she made down the front here and made the braid sort of entangle like a plant because they're very plant-like. I once did a piece with plants, leaves and all, coming up from braids, coming up from the ground and changing colour and into leaves. It's where your imagination is going to take you. Everybody interprets it in a different form. If you want to make things for closures on garments, then you get back to what the Chinese used to do a lot on their garments. They'd have these frog-type fastenings, which you can make braids for those. I worked with a weaver, Terry Flynn, in Baltimore to make jackets where we'd put braids down the centre and right round the neck. So it was enclosing fabric. It acted as a way to finish the edge of the fabric by enclosing an envelope of braid round the edge of the fabric. What do you do with braids? Braids are there every day in our lives, but we do not see them. Bag straps, handles, fastenings on all sorts of things, industrial use.
Yeah, I looked at climbing rope.
Okay, so that's a tubular braid made round a core. When Virginia Harvey was alive up here on Whidbey Island, I spent time with her one day with a man who was making a structure for retrieving objects in space from rocket.
That was Robert Forward, the space tether.
Yeah, space tether. Thank you. Yes, yeah. Well, I was with Virginia Harvey discussing the structure of that and how best to put that together. Whatever happened in the end, I don't know.
I met those guys from the other end, from my science fiction background.
Oh, did you now?
So I should follow up with them and go, space tether, what up?
Yes.
What happened with that?
Well, you can make your little braid and put it in the book as a bookmark.
There you go. So you're up here teaching right now. When you teach, what do you think is the most important thing you try to give to your students?
Confidence. When you meet a set of instructions for the first time, if you've not done it before, the first thing you've got to do is to find out how they interpret the instructions. I'm not a prescriptive teacher. I teach to the person. So I'll sit down and I'll talk quietly with the person if they're having difficulty to try and find out what they're doing and try to explain to them step by step what it is that they need to feel. Now you try it. And then everybody needs to be left alone to try a bit more by themselves. And you go back and you're continually sort of helping them to feel good about themselves and what they're doing. For me, that's what teaching's about.
Do people come to your class with a lot of fear of the Maradai because it's something they haven't done before?
Oh, yes. You can see the hair standing on as they walk through the door. No, I don't know how you assess that, whether they're fearful or not. They come because they're interested. This wouldn't be there. They come because they have a need to learn or want to learn or they would like to make something. It's no good just sort of saying, well, now this is the braid you're going to do, if they want to do something completely different with what they're learning. You have to find out that balance of the certain structures you should learn because it's a basis for wanting to do what you want to do. So you go through that process. You can't just go to the end thing and make it straight away.
Is there one particular tip that you find yourself saying over and over again? What's the most common mistake?
Moving the wrong threads. In Kumihimo structure or Peruvian sling braid, there's a structure of upper and lower threads. If you move an upper thread instead of a lower, you've lost it.
Well, I've got a Maradai at home. I'll have to go out and get over my fear of it.
What are you afraid about?
Well, what intimidates me is on my loom, all the threads are kind of locked in place. They're there, and they're evenly spaced, and the loom does all that for me. It seems like with the Maradai, you have so many freedoms of motion. And when we move the threads, I get obsessed about the angles. Maybe that's my scientific background. How crucial is it that those angles be exactly precise?
Well, the Maradai is divided in four areas, north, south, east, west. Okay, and there's sort of an imaginary line on a diagonal that separates them. And if you keep the prescribed number of threads in each quarter, and as long as those stay in their quarters, you get a symmetrical pattern. round. So if you move the north-south of the threads, which you normally do first, and then move the east and west, you have a symmetrical picture. Each time you move a set of north, south, east, west at the end of that two-step sequence, then they're going to be a mirror image. And that gives you an indication. You can also see there's going to be a pattern of upper and lower threads, which should also be identical mirror images. As soon as a thread moves, it's a lower thread. When you put it in position, it's become an upper thread. Does that make sense?
Yeah, because you've moved it from a below to an above.
Yeah.
Oh, that makes perfect sense. What's next for you?
What I decided to do is I've decided to go back to what I consider my roots, and that's back to Peruvian headband braids. That's where I started. I've kept on making because they just fascinate me. They're architectural. It's like making a suspension bridge in a sense because the structures meld together. They lock. And so the locking, in fact, holds the structure together. That fascinates me because it, in a sense, is all part of this oblique interlaced meshing. Although I've been making them all these years, I haven't been doing it, in inverted commas, seriously. And now I'm sort of going in depth. I'm now researching yarns to use. I'm certainly not going to work with original yarns. I've had to decide on certain things. I found now a Swedish yarn which I can use that's making samples nearer to the size of the original Peruvian ones. I'm trying to dye to the colours that they use. They won't be precise, but they give an image of what the originals look like.
Were the originals done in wool?
Most of the museums that I've visited, they're recorded as camelid. So put your money on that, whether it's alpaca or llama. Mary Frame is doing lots and lots of research. In 1980, she gave me a copy of a diagram from a book, the work of Lila O'Neill in the 1930s, and it showed a structure. And that's what hooked me on doing these Peruvian braids. Although I'd been doing them from 73, it wasn't until I got that, I thought, oh, that's wonderful. She's doing all the stuff that she's been doing all life. That's her career, not for me. I'm a person that helps to convey it to other people. Not in the same way that you would be a dedicated researcher. I can't visit all the museums in the world, and I cannot have time in museums studying detailed structure. But what I can do is work out the structure so that that piece can be remade, and that's what I'm doing now. And it's not just a question of how did it go together, how did they make it? What's the possible solutions for that? Which puts it in a situation where you can start thinking about, well, how do I convey this information in visual form and written form so that other people can learn it? That's what I feel I want to use my time for now.
One thing we haven't touched on yet is your travels.
I won a Winston Churchill Fellowship, which is like a Fulbright, to go to Japan in 1984. So that's where Makiko Tada and myself exchanged a lot of Peruvian Japanese information. I have been to Australia to teach on the continent in Europe. And, of course, I've been coming backwards and forwards to America for 15-odd years now. So each time I get near a museum, I'm knocking on the door.
Are there any museums that stand out?
Well, I got one that's on my doorstep, the British Museum. I've got access to the collection there. The outstanding museum I went to is in Japan, in Kobe, where I was there last November. And because I was allowed to handle and look at the collection of braids that they have. And in that way, you got very close and personal with them in a way that I've not been able to do before. And they've got a huge collection of a variety. The other person who's helped me since 1982, when I first came to America, is Ann Rowe at the Textile Museum. Unfortunately, Ann Rowe is no longer working for the Textile Museum, so I don't know how that's going to work out in the future. But she's been a great help to me.
I'd like to ask a bit about the video that you did for Victorian Videos.
Oh, yeah. That was fun.
What was that experience?
Intense. I'd never been under a camera before. I had to write a script. Virginia got me to rewrite it immediately in a way that they were going to present it. So she wanted to know how I go through it. Of course, making a video, of course, has to be done in quite a different way. The way that you as a craftsperson might think of it. But it was all sort of cut and pause and go back, retake things, and can you speak louder or whatever you've got to do. But I thought it was fascinating, and I'd really like to have done one for the Takadai. I think that would be a real help to people, and just for the fun of doing it.
Could you please briefly describe the Takadai? Not as many people are familiar with it as the Marodai.
I'll have a shot.
I know, you're kind of limited by not having pictures.
Yeah. Takadai now is on a stand. You can sit in a chair and work on it. It's a square frame and it's on the slope, sloping upwards away from where you're sitting. On the left and right hand side are two runners which are inserted at what's called coma with pegs on. And these slide up and down and hold the threads that come from a central point on the furthest bar that's facing you at the back. And these threads come out, and it's that that gives you the oblique in structure. So they're all fanned out, so it's not like weaving vertical threads all facing you that you're passing away through. Each one of those threads that are sitting there, you usually have the odd number on the side. So you'd have 13, for example, on your right-hand side and 12 thread on the left. And the first thread that's on the upper point away from you is cast through a shed that you make with your hand. So you weave your hand through up and down, up and down, up and down. And then the last thread, you press all those down to make an opening, a shed to which you pass the last thread through and place it at the nearest point to you on the other side. And that way you're weaving. I call it weave, and I use weaving terms because most people can relate to those without creating a new language. So it's a language people understand. So you're making plain weave or twill structure, or you can do other structures as well, but they're the two basics. And you're continually working from side to side. The bobbins are weighted exactly as for the maradai. It's like Tai Chi. You're working on a takadai. The way you move your hands, it's graceful. It's like conducting an orchestra. It's the same gentle movement. You can feel the energies in your hand and your fingers. That's where it is. Well, I decided one day, well, I'd try and make something wide. So I started making things about 10 inches wide, the things being scarves. And I used zephyr, that's the silk wool mix. Now, Richard Sutherland, who has been working with me for 15 years, took it a lot further. He's done a lot of scarves, and they're really beautiful scarves. And they're far more symmetrical than mine. Mine are sort of a bit more wavy and more supple. He's been using zephyr as well, but he's made a great thing into scarves and done them so well. And you can create all sorts of weave patterns in them. You've got a plain weave structure or a twill structure. You can translate weave structures into those. I've done 3-in-1 twill on a takadai to make a scarf length. So you can translate lots of things.
Well, what's fascinating to me from your description is how each thread, it seems, can be either weft or warped.
That's right, yeah. So it just takes a turn. Each one will become a weft and a warp.
I know the tools are different, but is the feeling that you get when you weave a Peruvian braid different than when you're sitting in a maradai? Or is it the same intellectual pleasure?
If you're talking about the headbands that I'm coming to do nowadays, Peruvian braids, I think, demand more exactness. When you work on the maradai, it's like the takadai. It's a rhythmical thing. You know, your hands move and you're dancing with the threads. With the Peruvian structures, most of them are twined. So the whole movement is different and it doesn't have that rhythm to it. I mean, you do develop a sort of rhythm, but it's not the expansive rhythm that you'd get with Japanese equipment.
Well, I really hope you get a chance to make that takadai video. It sounds fascinating.
Well, nobody's asked me.
Well, I'm sure if they...
I want somebody to ask me out there.
Ooh.
These are the Peruvian ones.
Ooh, this is so cool. Ooh, that is just fascinating. And it's exactly what you said. The threads are kind of going in diagonals and then interlacing again. And it's just, I can't immediately understand it, but it is really cool.
That one's from the Textile Museum. I was there last week and I was looking at the original against this. And the original, I suppose, is about that wide. And this is the Swedish yarn I'm using now. So what's happening is I'm trying to get nearer to the size of the original, so it looks more authentic.
So they were using very fine yarns then?
Oh, gosh, yes. Oh, they're so fine. I'm so respective of the skills of those people in those days. I mean, they're just masters of weaving techniques.
That's all for this episode. And now it's time to get warped, or perhaps in this case, to set up your maradai. Because everyone knows you have to be warped to weave. Audio production for this episode was provided by Ruth Temple and Sign Mitchell. Our theme music, Limerick Rake, is by Celtic Reboot, who generously made it available on the Podcast Music Network. Our sponsors this episode were Braider's Hand and Webbs. Over the last 9 years, Braider's Hand has established a reputation for building the finest Kumihimo equipment money can buy. Their equipment is built using hard maple in their workshop in Washington State. They offer traditional silk and synthetic threads, books, Kumihimo disc and plate kits, and books on other forms of braiding. Please visit their website for details, www.braidershand.com. Yarn.com is the online home of Webbs, America's yarn store, where you'll find everything you need for weaving and more. Webbs carries a variety of yarns, accessories, tools, and looms for weavers from beginner to advanced. Save up to 25% off your yarn and book order every day at yarn.com.